The Cycling Podcast presents Life in the Peloton. Hi, I'm Mitch Stocker, and welcome to Life in the Peloton. Over the course of the next week, we're running some re-edited versions of some of my favourite and some of the crowd favourites of Life in the Peloton podcasts over the last 4 years. The last episode was Daryl Impey, and this time we're listening to Marcel Kittel. I sat down with Marcel after Paris-Nice way back in 2017, not way back, but a few years ago anyway, in the height of his career. And it was fantastic. We sat down over a beer once again, and we just chatted. Marcel and I were teammates way back in Skill Shimano back in 2010, and it really didn't feel like it was that many years between it. So this is a really great episode to see the difference mindset that Marcel was in back then and to the mindset that we know he was in by the end of his career at the end of the last year. Stay tuned, because coming up on the 29th of January will be the release of the first official 2020 Life in the Peloton episode presented by the Cycling Podcast with Jimmy Whelan. So I hope you can sit back and enjoy this episode. We are sitting here in Girona with my old teammate, good friend, Marcel Kittel, and we're actually enjoying a cold beer.
Yes, we do.
This is actually the first time I think I've had a beer when doing a podcast.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's sad.
It is sad. I was just saying, very sad. We normally have a cup of tea because we're on a race or something. Welcome to Life in the Peloton. And today I want to talk to you about becoming a sprinter. To go back to the beginning, and you're going to have to correct me if I'm wrong along the way here. You were a TT, a time trialist, and in the beginning, you know, 2005, 2006, you were world junior time trial champion. So not just any time trialist, an awesome one. You know, and then following that, 2007, 2009, 2010, you were German TT time trial champion, European time trial champion, under 23, and then third of the world. So it was looking like you were going to be the next Tony Martin, you could say.
I was definitely on a good way.
You're on a good way, exactly.
Yeah, for sure.
And challenging out. I know Luke Durbridge, he's a good time trialist too. And he always used to speak to me, "Oh, Marcel, you used to be this freak time trialist." And I said, "Well, he probably still is a freak time trialist, but he doesn't do them anymore, full gas." But then in 2011, you signed professional with Skill Shimano. I was on that team, and we met there. And I didn't realise, I thought your first sprint was with me in a race called 4 Days of Dunkirk in France. But I actually was just having a look before, and I noticed that your first sprint victory with the team was the Tour of Langkawi.
Yeah.
And what I wanted to speak to you about today was that transition from suddenly being a time trialist, then suddenly winning these sprints early in your career. And take me through that Langkawi sprint. Was the team going, "Marcel, I think you can sprint," or it just happened that way? Or tell me about it.
So I will start with that transition, which is actually, it's hard to, actually it's not hard to describe, but it might be a bit hard to understand how someone who was maybe successful in his youth in time trial that he suddenly turned into a sprinter. That's what people see when they check results, but you have to know that when I started cycling, actually after 1 or 2 years, I really started to win races in sprints and not in time trials.
Right.
And,
in your juniors?
Even before, in the under 15. That's, I think, and then afterwards with 16 I got German champion, youth champion, in a sprint, and that was actually my biggest result until then. And when I started cycling with 13, 14, I was really lucky to have a training group at my hometown where we would do the training together, also the racing, and that's where we also started to do in those small races to work really as a team for the sprint, because we said, okay, Marcel, he's the fastest, and we are going to do a lead out for you. So that's actually what we did there. It's already the same what I'm doing now still.
Back in those days.
Yeah.
Because really. From what I understood was that you and John Degenkolb were coming, same age, came through the juniors together. And I don't know, I understood that he was always a sprinter and you were the time trialist. And then you came to Skill and, you know, you started sprinting there. But previous to that, you were already sprinting.
Yeah. So what I just said is that happened around, I don't know, before the juniors, before I came there. So when I came into the juniors, in that time, also my coach said to me, with the success that I had sometimes, in the years before in time trial, that I would have a good chance to also get good results in time trial. It was always clear I would go for a sprint, but let's try also time trial. And yeah, it's...
That worked, yeah.
Yeah, it worked very well. It's hard to explain where it comes from, but... apparently I was at that time really good in time trial and also in sprint. But what happened in that period is, I think that's something that you shouldn't forget, is also that I made mentally a change from a sprinter more to a time trialist. So I really focused more on that. I also trained more on that, like longer power trainings on the bike. And that, in the end, changed me also from my focus more in the direction of time trial than sprint.
Which is a totally different mentality.
It is totally a different mentality. Yeah.
So then talk me through when you came onto Skill Shimano. Were you signed as a time trialist?
I was signed. I still remember those discussions for the contract. The team came up to me. They said, okay, listen, Marcel, we think you are a really good time trialist and we are really convinced that you will have a good chance in the lead out for our sprinters. So that was my role.
Who was the sprinter? Kenny Van Hummel. Imagine lead outs you would have done.
That's how I started in the team. And then when we started to do training camps together in Mallorca, I still remember Mallorca. That was the first training camp where I won the sprint against anyone else.
Yeah.
There, the training sprint. That's, I think, where everyone, maybe Kenny especially, got a bit scared.
We just like absolutely annihilate, because I wasn't there that year, I remember. And what, did you just annihilate them in the sprints?
Yeah, I actually, yeah. So there was nobody who had any chance against me. That was pretty funny. But at that point, for myself, I didn't really realize, how far I can get in the professionals with that sprint, because I had no possibility to compare it.
Yeah, you're like, okay, it's a training sprint. Yeah. That was good, but we're training.
Everyone can win a training. Yeah. Not everyone, but
it's different.
It's different. Yeah, it's very different to a race.
So what, then you went to Langkawi?
And then the first race was Langkawi. And the first stage was, I think, 120 kilometers. Not sure how long exactly, but not very long. We arrived there as a pro continental team in style just the day before. 6 hours time difference, 30 degrees difference in temperature, and everyone was super tired, and we tried to do the lead out for Kenny on that day, and that didn't work at all, because I was I couldn't handle my responsibilities or my positions. I had no experience what actually the team, also Kenny Van Hummel as a sprinter, expected from me. So Kenny then said, okay, Marcel, listen, we are going to change the positions now. Tomorrow, so on stage two, we are going to do the lead out for you.
Wow.
And then you will see how we do it. And then we try to keep on working, that you actually learn what you...
How good is that from Kenny?
Yeah, I can honestly say Kenny was very fair to me.
And, yeah.
Till now, I still have a good relationship with him. At that time, he was a crazy sprinter.
He was.
And he's also famous for that. But in the end, that was my start, because the next day I won the stage. And it was my first professional win.
In a specific race for a sprint stage, what is your protocol that you might run by?
I personally always try to concentrate on what we... talked about or discussed the day before, or in the morning before the race, as a team, where we want to be as a team. It's also important for me to see that my teammates, they are sharp, they know what we want to do today, what we want to achieve. And I think I did my best sprints knowing that everything is planned and I can just go in the final now. And I know that we have a plan and we will just stay together and see what happens. And when I can also feel, you know, when I'm relaxed, it's for me much easier to go into a final than if I'm not, which is probably very normal. It's for everyone the same.
Yeah.
And because you can just keep your focus much better on what is really important in that stage, on the final. I don't know, maybe there is a sharp corner at kilometer 3 where you want to be in front. But I don't really have like a routine that I follow in the final. It's just all about seeing a little bit how the bunch behaves, feeling also myself. Am I nervous? Am I still calm? And to be honest, a sprint is always so different to what you maybe discussed in a meeting before or what you were expecting, that for me it's almost wrong to expect anything. So actually I go a lot of times just in the final thinking, okay, if I stay on the wheel of my guys, nothing will happen to me. And if we are on position 50 at 1.2 kilometers to go, we will still be able to find a way to come somehow to the front.
That's an amazing trust, because that's one thing I've noticed with working with a lot of sprinters. That's you're trying to get that trust with them and say, hey, and you believe yourself that you will get them there, but you want them to go, look, if we are on position 50 with 2K to go, don't worry, we'll be there.
Yeah.
But a lot of sprinters naturally go, they freak out. They're like, you know what? I can do my job, this job better, and I can get my own way to the front. And they get there in the wind, the sprint happens, and they're buggered. And building that trust up is a big thing. And it's interesting to hear you say that. Has there been there times where you've gone, geez, I trusted you guys, and you buggered it up. Like, you didn't get me to the front where you said, or whatever happened. And do you lose the trust then? Or you're just like, cool, that can happen?
I think it's important that this happens, because that's where you see, you know, for sure you see mistakes or problems that you still have in a lead out, for example, as a team. So you can learn from it, you are able to discuss it. But what is also important is in those difficult moments when your team is really challenged to still find a solution to the problem, to bring your sprinter to the front, then you know who has a feeling for the sprint, for the last 2 kilometers, who can really stay calm when guys are maybe crashing or stuff like this is happening, because it freaks out a lot of guys, not only sprinters. And I guess that's where the real quality of a team can be seen. And a lot of times, or like now in Quickstep, I have my lead out man with Fabio Sabatini, and I know, like I said before, if I'm on position 50 at 1.5 kilometers to go, I'm sure, and even if he has to sacrifice himself way too early already, he will bring me in the final. And that trust is really, really important. And if you have one guy, or maybe even still a second one, then yeah, your lead out is almost always sure, or you know that you will.
Yeah, but then how did you get to that level of trust with him so fast? It was just from day one, he did a good job and you were like, oh, this guy's good. Or someone told you, or, you know, because it is a big thing to take on.
Yeah, I think I can honestly say I got also very lucky that I could meet Saba, for example, when I changed teams from Giant to Quickstep, and that, you know, that he was there, and
really?
I didn't know him, you know, before that, and suddenly we are in a race together. The team expects us to do sprints and lead outs together, and you have no clue who that person actually is. So that's a really weird situation in the beginning, but
And there's a lot of expectation on you to win the stage, and you're like, shit, now I'm just trusting this guy I've got no idea about.
Yeah. So what I did is, when I came into Quickstep, for example, I asked to room in the training camp with not only Saba, but also with other lead-out guys like Max Richese, to really get to know them and to get a feeling for each other. That's very important. And I think that worked very well.
Yeah, it did, yeah, it did. Tell me, off the topic of sprinting now, it's a simple question, but tell me what you really love about the job of cycling. This is something that I had an accident last year in Roubaix, and I got a chance to reset and had a chance to think about, you know, do I really love the sport? I was doing the sport, and you get caught up in it, and you like we were just discussing before this podcast, You're looking at the next thing all the time.
Yeah.
And you're not actually taking in that moment, going, you know, do I actually love this sport? And I had a moment where I was just out riding, no training or anything. I just went, you know what? I'm just going to find out if I still love riding. Went out riding up in Andorra, and I was like, wow, I love this. And then the next step was, do I want to race? And then, you know, it went from there. But I found the love for cycling that I always had, but I realized it. So for you, if you can think about it, what are those moments that you really love about the sport?
Oh, that's a difficult question.
Yeah. Something you don't think about. You give a normal answer, you know, oh, yeah, I love it, you know, get on.
No. Yeah, it's you know, maybe I just start when I started cycling in general. Actually, when I started cycling, that was a period where I just a couple of months before I finished to do track and field sprinting and stuff like this.
Mm.
And I was bored during the summer, so we went on holiday as a family, and I asked my father, he was always on the bike, would you get me a bicycle? I would just try cycling and see if it is something for me or not. So he got me a bike. We did the first 30 kilometers together. It was a really, really hot summer day. And I came home and I was completely dead, really. I was in the kitchen on the floor. It was really cold, cold floors with tiles. And I had my legs up against the wall and I was completely empty. But I really enjoyed that moment. You know, when that's a moment when you're really exhausted, but you can feel your
that legs sense are of little, achievement. Yeah.
Yeah, your legs are a little bit itchy and you're just proud of what you just did. And I guess that was one of the reasons why I really like to do sports in general, but also cycling in particular, because that feeling when you did a 6 or 7 hour ride is it's hard to probably don't get it somewhere else in your life. And
it's a
beautiful feeling. And after that I kept doing cycling, I kept riding my bike. And actually, the first winter I had was the worst winter ever. So we did 3-4 hour rides, or actually 3 hour rides in 2 degrees and snow and rain, and I really hated it. I came home, I cried, and my father said to my mother, I heard it. I think he doesn't know, but I heard it. If he survives that winter, he will continue, because I really, in that moment, I thought, why should I do that stupid shit riding in the rain? It's cold. Other guys are just sitting at home watching television, hanging out with their friends, and I'm here on the bike, doing that stuff. But in the end, when you come home, even after a very cold ride, you're very proud of what you did.
Yeah. Yes.
That's one of the moments in sport that really keep motivating me, and probably that's the main reason why I keep riding my bike, besides the fact that I just, you know, like to, I'm competitive, I like to win, I also like that feeling.
No, that was more the answer I was looking for, the true answer, you know, that's it, you know, you've got to have that, it's bigger than winning, you know, it's bigger than the money, it's bigger than the you know, because it's at the end of the day, it's you doing those rides out there.
I never started cycling, you know, with the idea to become a professional.
Mm.
In that moment, I had no role models. In that time, typically children would have Jan Ulrich, for example, as a role model. But that was never the case for me. For me, my father was my role model. He was the guy who guided me also into the sport, who, you know, helped me to set up my bike or my helmet, stuff like this. And I guess I really just did it because, you know, I enjoyed riding with him. I also later enjoyed riding with my training group at home, and we did the races. We lived this life on the road, you know, in this really small bus where we went to the races. All very simple, but really, really cool. Mm, really,
really fun.
Really
times.
Nice memories also.
And then now, to change the mood, what are the things that you actually hate?
I think what I don't like as a professional is everything that comes with being a professional, all that stuff that is not really directly related to cycling, all the
media, you know, and all that stuff.
All the media, all the other obligations that you have to fulfill, yeah, of course, also the pressure is something which is completely different. If you just ride your bike for fun, it's a completely different situation compared to being a professional who gets paid, who has expectations for races, to win races also.
I guess I guess it's a love-hate relationship with that too, because that pressure, like you said before, makes those victories all the more sweeter. You know, if that pressure wasn't there,
yes,
victories would still be good, but would they be as good?
No, of course not. I mean,
you know what I mean?
Winning in the Tour means you survived a really big load of pressure. You know, everyone is happy with your result, and you can really feel, or I personally always feel in the Tour, okay, whew, I'm happy that it's done. You know, when I won a race or when I finished the Tour in general, because it's such an exhausting race. That's probably one of the downsides in cycling, because it's very competitive on a professional level, which is normal, but probably it's very different to what you would do if you just, you know, if you are on your bike to enjoy it.
Yeah, it is totally different. It is totally.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that one with Marcel and I. I can tell you, once the microphone went off, we were able to crack into one or two more little beers afterwards as well. So it was a fantastic moment there with Marcel. Not only just recording the episode, but just catching up and having a few cold ones. I want to say thank you to all the producers behind in the cycling podcast, helping putting these small episodes together, and to the future with the Life in the Peloton episodes coming up in 2020. I want to say thank you also to my personal producer, Lara, who's helping me behind the scenes as well with Life in the Peloton. Well, it's not too long now to the real release of the first official 2020 episode, so hang in there. Jimmy Whelan is just around the corner on the 29th of January. You have been listening to Life in the Peloton. The producer of this episode was Will Jones. The music in this episode was composed by Pete Shelley. Thanks, mate.